Hey everyone. In today's shiur, we're going to shift and we're going to transition from dealing with tshuvos, with responsa that have up until now dealt with a population in the United States, or in America really, of Sephardic immigrants, of Central European, generally German-speaking immigrants, and we're going to transition to deal with responsa that begin to deal with Eastern European immigrants. Now, just in terms of our timeline, so the tshuvos that we're going to discuss today are from the mid-19th century, the 1850s, 1860s, possibly, and then, excuse me, at the end of the shiur with one that's later. For the most part, these tshuvos are not reflective of the experience of the vast wave, the giant wave, if you will, of Eastern European immigration that comes beginning in the late 19th and ending in the early 20th century, excuse me, from approximately 1881 to 1924 is generally the years given for that wave of immigration. For the most part, again, and you'll see why I'm saying for the most part as we get to the towards the end of this year, but for the most part, these tshuvos deal with Eastern European immigrants that come before the major wave of immigration that comes from that part of the world. And the reason, aside from the halachic material and the interesting halachic issues that come up in the material that we'll deal with today, aside from that, we'll see how this halachic material in these tshuvos are deeply intertwined with important historical and communal issues that were being dealt with by those first Eastern European immigrants, and a little bit some of the later Eastern European immigrants that come to the United States. Okay. There is, as I just mentioned, there's a trickle, really a trickle of Eastern European immigrants that come from Eastern European immigrants obviously come from Eastern Europe, excuse me, in the first half of the 19th century. As we've mentioned before, the vast majority of immigrants at this time are coming from Central Europe, from primarily German-speaking lands. But there's a trickle, there's a very small number of immigrants that are beginning to come from Eastern Europe. And the first congregation, so the first called shul, the first congregation of Eastern European immigrants is founded on the Lower East Side in the year 1852. So again, just to keep our timeline set, we said that the major wave of Eastern European immigrants begins in approximately what most historians give the year of 1881 for various reasons. So this is happening approximately 30 years prior to that, is when the first congregation of Eastern European immigrants is founded in on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And that congregation is named Congregation Beth Hamedrash, Beis Hamedrash, if you will. Very briefly, to give us some of the very brief history of this congregation leading up to the episode that we're going to discuss more in depth. The congregation, again, is founded in 1852. From the records that we have, there are approximately 12 men that are named on something of a charter or so of that first congregation, and they come from various places in Eastern Europe. And the congregation moved from one place to another, all on the Lower East Side. They were in storefronts. They were in one of the most interesting places that we see in their records is that they used, I believe it was the upper gallery of a courthouse. Why did they use the upper gallery of a courthouse? Because the lower gallery was being used by a different congregation. And so they're finding all kinds of nooks and crannies, all kinds of various places which they can use, obviously on a temporary basis. In 1856, so 4 years after the congregation is founded, They move into their first permanent home, which is at 78 Allen Street on the Lower East Side. So what? Sounds great, right? They move into a permanent home. What's the problem? And this is where the problems begin. The problem was that 78 Allen Street was formerly a church. In the literature, it's referred to as a Welsh church, right, from Wales. And 78 Allen Street, this building that congregation Beth HaMedrash moves into, was formerly a church. Which brings us to the beginnings of the conflict and the beginnings of the issue that we're going to deal with. So, a little bit, I always say this, but a little bit of historical and halakhic background to the question of turning a church into a shul. Right, that was the question that came up. Can this building, which was formerly a church, can it become a shul? Now, you already, many of you may be already thinking, well, I've been to shuls that once upon a time were churches, or I've heard of shuls that once upon a time were churches. We're not dealing, okay, I just want to clarify, we are not dealing with what perhaps now is a more common issue, which is where, unfortunately, shuls in generally more inner city neighborhoods, you find this in the Bronx a lot, you find this in other parts of say, Brooklyn and in other places across the country, really, where old shuls, where the congregations have left those parts of the city and they have become churches. We are not dealing with that issue at all. We're dealing with the opposite of, can a shul buy a building that was once upon a time used as a church, or maybe even immediately prior to the purchase of the building was used as a church, can they turn it into a shul? Now, interestingly, from a historical point of view, this is a new world problem. This is a new world question, because in Europe, there was no possibility of doing this. This wasn't an option. The distinctions between religions, and therefore the distinctions between religious buildings, churches, shuls, etc., were very sharp. Those distinctions were sharp, and it wasn't even an option to say, hey, we're going to buy this church and turn it into a shul. So this is a new world problem. It comes up in America. And again, if we look 1852, or 1856 rather, when this problem comes up on the Lower East Side with this Eastern European congregation, Beth HaMedrash, this wasn't the first time that a congregation here in America did turn a church into a shul. We have records of various, even congregations that exist till today, prominent congregations of Ashkenazi, and I'm emphasizing that, of Ashkenazi communities who turned churches into shuls. So this had been going on for years by the time this particular episode came up on the Lower East Side. Now, why am I emphasizing the fact that this was being done by Ashkenazi congregations? Presumably, okay, I don't have a 100% accurate answer necessarily, but presumably is because the Ashkenazi congregations were newer. They had come in more recent years to the United States. The Sephardic congregations had been here for a much longer period, so those historic Sephardic congregations in New York, in Philadelphia, in Charleston, etc., they were older, they were more mature, and therefore, for the most part, were wealthier. The Ashkenazi congregations were newer, and therefore not as wealthy, and they couldn't necessarily afford to build their own buildings, afford to build new buildings, and so therefore they kind of take whatever they can get, and in some cases, that means a church and buying it and turning it into a shul. Okay, so again, this is the question that came up. Can this Welsh church at 78 Allen Street on New York's Lower East Side, can it be turned into a shul? So before we get to how this episode played out on the Lower East Side and beyond, really, let's just briefly go through the halachic material, the halachic background that's going to be central to answering and dealing with this question. So the Shulchan Aruch says, doesn't deal with this exact question. The Shulchan Aruch rules that candles, says wax candles, that were given to Ovdei Avodah Zarah, that were given to idol worshippers, cannot then be used in a shul, right? So that's the case that the Shulchan Aruch discusses. Again, wax candles that were used in, that were given to idol worshippers, the assumption of being that they were used in some sort of idol worship, right? Some sort of worship that is prohibited according to the Torah, cannot then be used in a shul. The Ramah there adds that, well, they can't be used in a shul, but they are permitted to be used for mundane purposes. So it seems like a pretty clear-cut case. If we just look at the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, it seems that since the building, right, this Welsh church, was used for idolatry, parenthetically, in an important parenthesis, I don't want to get into the whole issue of the status of Christianity according to Halacha, whether yes, whether no, is it considered idolatry, is it not considered idolatry? There's vast, vast amounts of literature on that. It will be important soon, but that's beyond the purview of today's shiur. However, some distinctions, perhaps within Christianity, are going to become important soon. But again, it's not the main topic of the shiur. So again, based on this psak of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, it would seem to be clear cut. The building was used for, let's assume that the status of Christianity for our purposes is prohibited, is idolatry, certainly for Jews. So if it was used for such a purpose, so then presumably the building cannot be used as a shul. That's the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. However, comes the Magen Avraham. And the Magen Avraham makes an important comment. He says that only the object itself, only if an object itself was used for idolatrous purposes, does the object become forbidden. But if a building merely housed idol worship, right? But the building itself was not worshipped. It merely housed the worship that was, and the worshipers that were engaged in this worship, then it's okay. So that's the comment and the caveat, the important caveat that the Magen Avraham makes. That's, in a nutshell, the halachic background to this issue. So now, let's now travel back from the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, and the Magen Avraham. Let's now come back to 19th century on the Lower East Side. And we have to introduce two important individuals to our story, two important individuals that lived on the Lower East Side at the time. One is Rabbi Abraham or Avraham Ash, and one is Rabbi Yehuda or Judah Middleman. Who were these people? Rabbi Ash was basically considered to be the spiritual leader of the congregation, and Rabbi Middleman was another learned individual on the Lower East Side. He was not the rabbi or the spiritual leader of this congregation, but he was a learned individual, and these two people, they had some previous feuds between them within the community on the Lower East Side, particularly involving issues of shechita, of ritual slaughter, and they were known adversaries within the community. Okay, so it's not surprising that there were two people within a community that didn't like each other so much. And they had engaged in prior feuds to this, and this issue of the shul and the church becoming the shul becomes the next episode in their battle, in their animosity towards each other. So, how did this play out between them? How did their adversarial relationship play out in this case? So again, 1856, the congregation Beth HaMedrash, which is led by Rabbi Ash, purchases this former Welsh church, which becomes their shul. And Rabbi Ash, who's the spiritual leader, is the rabbi, and for all intents and purposes, the posek of this community. He believed that it was fine. He believed that it was okay to use this former church as a shul. That was Rabbi Ash's opinion. However, he is then challenged by Rabbi Yehuda Mittelman. Rabbi Yehuda Mittelman, who does, I'm not saying his only motivation in challenging Ash was because he didn't like him, but we know that he didn't like him prior to this, and he challenges Rabbi Ash on this Psak Halacha. And as a result, okay, so as a result of this disagreement between these two individuals on the Lower East Side, we have a series of tshuvos, okay, so it's fascinating how these things develop, but we have a series of tshuvos from two of the leading poskim of Europe at the time on this very issue. How so? So both Rabbi Ash and Rabbi Mittelman sent their halachic inquiries to different poskim in Europe in order to ascertain the permissibility, or the opposite, right, of using the church as a shul. So who did they send their shilos? Who did they send their questions to? As I said, these are two of the leading poskim of Europe, different parts of Europe at the time. Rabbi Yehuda Mittelman sent his inquiry to Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson, author of Shu'ot, Shilos Tshuvos, Shoal Umeshiv. He was the leading posek with a capital P of Galicia of the time. And here we can see a connection. Both Rabbi Mittelman, who lived in America, and Rabbi Nathanson, they were both from Lvov, right, the major center in Galicia. They were both from Lvov, which helps us understand why Rabbi Mittelman sent his question to Rabbi Nathanson. Rabbi Ash sent his inquiry to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who was the leading posek, again, capital P there, leading posek of Germany at the time. It's unclear, right? And I've thought about this, and I've looked into this, and I'm not sure what the answer to this is as to why Rabbi Ash, who was not from Germany, he was not from that part of the world, not that part of Europe, it's unclear why he decided to send his question specifically to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, but okay, that's who he sent it to, and that's who we have the tshuvos from. So let's begin actually with the second question, the second shaila, right, the one sent by Rabbi Ash. Let's actually begin with Rav Ettlinger's response. So responding to Rabbi Ash, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger allowed the use of the building based on three factors. Now, one thing to keep in mind is he's not so happy about their use of this building. He reluctantly allows it, but allows it nonetheless, and based on three basic factors. He says as follows. He says, and I left out some of the details at the beginning. I didn't want to go into all of the various details just for the sake of time. But he says, since the building had not initially been designated as a church, meaning it wasn't this building, this Welsh church didn't begin as a Welsh church. It began actually as a private residence. So it wasn't built and designated as a church to begin with. Says Rav Ettlinger, therefore, it lacked the status as a permanent structure of, quote, idolatrous worship. And so, therefore, that's one factor, lahakel, to be lenient. The second factor, which he takes into account, he says, even had the building been designated as a structure, a permanent structure for Christian worship, we know that there's a concept called bitul avodah zara, of nullification of idol worship. Again, the details of that are complex and beyond the purview of this shiur, but he says the sale of the building by the Christian congregation constituted a form of nullification, of bitul, and therefore he says it was okay to use. So again, two factors. My apologies. He says, despite these factors, he wasn't eager to allow the congregation to use it. He wasn't enthusiastic about it, but he basically says in his response to Rabbi Ash, he says that since they don't have another option, Since they've already bought this and they don't, right, as we said before, they were moving around from place to place, so they don't really have another great option, so therefore they can use this. That is what Rabbi Ettlinger responded to Rabbi Ash. So now let's come to the other Shaila and the other Tshuva, right? So the one sent from Rabbi Middleman to Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson in Galicia, in Lviv. So here too, Rav Nathanson permits the use of the building, and believe it or not, he's actually quite enthusiastic about this. And he enthusiastically allows the congregation to use this former church as a shul. How so? Again, on what basis? So here, Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson explains as follows. Remember I said, I'm not going to get into all the halachic complexities of the status of Christianity, but some distinctions within that question are going to become important. So one of them is forms one of the primary bases upon which Rav Nathanson formulates his opinion, and his lenient opinion, where he says that since this was a Protestant church, it was a Protestant church, which means that there were no icons and there are no statues in the building itself, and there were no icons and statues that were used within the worship, the Christian worship that was conducted in that building. So therefore, he says, it is permissible. In fact, I'll read to you, obviously a translation of mine, of the words of Rabbi Nathanson and his understanding, if you will, of the type of worship that went on in this Protestant Welsh congregation. So I quote again in translation. He says, "What do they do?" He says, "There's the recitation of hymns to that man, i.e., Jesus, and then they dance. Afterwards, a man gets up and preaches loftily about that man, again Jesus, while the congregation stands attentively and listens. And when he finishes preaching, they sing and they dance again." There's somewhat of an amusing description about this from this posek sitting in Lviv in Galicia as to what goes on in a Protestant congregation. But okay, the point is that there's no, as we said, there were no icons and no statues. And so therefore, according to Rav Nathanson, there was no problem with using the building for a shul. And in fact, Rav Nathanson goes even further, and he says not only is it not a problem, not only is it mutter to use this this building as a shul, but he says it's actually a mitzvah to do so. It's a positive act, as he says. Again, I'll quote in translation. He says, "In conclusion, according to my humble opinion, it seems that here, since there is no statue or image, it is permissible to turn it into a synagogue, into a shul, and according to my opinion, is a mitzvah to sanctify the name of heaven and turn it into a synagogue." Basically, according to Rav Nathanson, turning a Beis Avodah Zarah, turning a house of idolatry, albeit not full-fledged idolatry in his mind, but some sort of idolatry, turning it into a shul for the worship of Hashem, is actually a mitzvah. So those are the answers that were received both by Rabbi Ash as well as by Rabbi Middleman. So both permitted, both Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, albeit reluctantly, and Rav Nathanson, enthusiastically, permitted the usage of this building. What's really interesting, though, from a more historical point of view, is not the answers that they received, that Ash and Middleman received, but rather the questions that were asked and how they asked the questions. And this gets back to the feud between Rabbis Ash and Middleman. So listen carefully. Again, we're going to go back to how we know what the answers are, but now let's go back to how the questions were asked. Remember, Rabbi Ash was in favor of using the building. And so how did he compose his question to Ettlinger? Is as follows. Listen carefully, again, in translation. He says, "The heads of the shul were forced to purchase a building for the synagogue, and they could only attain a building that was initially built as a home. Later, it was purchased by Gentile priests to worship a trinity. They prayed to their God for a number of years, but did not bring any idolatrous image into the building. Now they have sold it, and we would like to know whether we can make this building into a house of study for Torah and prayer. The way Rabbi Ash is presenting the case to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger is in such a way where he's presenting the facts. Again, I'm not accusing him of any sort of intellectual dishonesty, but I am showing that the way that he presented the facts is that he's telling him, we were forced to do this, we had no other choice, right? He's presenting the facts of there were clearly no images in the building. It's almost as if he's trying to get a particular answer out of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. That is how Rabbi Ash, who again wanted the use of this building, that's how he presented the case and the facts to the posek, to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger in Europe. On the flip side, and we'll see how Rav Yehuda Middleman presents the facts, and you'll see what I mean. Again, you'll see what I mean by why that's significant in terms of how the question was asked. Rav Middleman presented the case, and then he received a positive answer, like we said. And he received a positive answer from Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson. An enthusiastic answer, even, from Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson. But if you look then, there's a subsequent question, right? So this is really the kicker, which really shows us how we read the questions that were asked, and in terms of how they're reflective of the feud between these two individuals on the Lower East, two rabbis on the Lower East Side. So there's a, once Rabbi Middleman received the positive answer, which he clearly didn't want, from Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson, he asks a follow-up question. And this is how it's recorded in Rav Nathanson's Tshuvos. He says, later his second letter arrived from the third of Sivan, explaining at length how the building was designated for forbidden worship. Meaning Rav Middleman is not giving up, and he's saying, no, I don't like, right, what you said. Really, this building was designated for forbidden worship. Is like, he's almost like as if he's saying, well, Rav Nathanson, maybe you missed that part, right? He's presenting it again in order to get an answer that he didn't receive the first time. And so what does Rav Nathanson in Galicia, what does he respond to him? He rejects this outright. He says, I don't understand. Since anything that does not have a statue or image is not considered designated for idol worship, therefore it is permissible. So again, the second inquiry provides clear evidence that Middleman was pressing Rav Nathanson to change his answer and to prove Rabbi Abraham Ash wrong. And so it would seem that, again, I'm not accusing anyone of intellectual dishonesty, but it would seem, reflected in the questions that were asked, that both Rabbi Ash and particularly Rabbi Middleman, wanted a specific answer as to the permissibility or lack thereof of using this building. Use of halacha in rabbinic wars has quite a long history. In this case of the Lower East Side, right, what happened, and the shul and the church. So these rabbinic authorities used, I'm trying to say this carefully, but they used these halachic decisions as a tool in this rabbinic confrontation, maybe personal confrontation, between these two rabbis, between Rabbi Ash and Middleman on the Lower East Side. However, the usage of halacha in rabbinic wars is different than this case. Usually, halacha is used when what? Intercommunally, right? Particularly in the modern era between Orthodox and Reform, Orthodox and non-Orthodox. Generally, halacha is used as a flashpoint, if you will, and maybe even a tool in these types of intercommunal wars, battles. In this case, we're talking about an intracommunal battle between two individuals. Usually they're between groups where the ideological division is apparent, is clear. Here we're talking about a personal battle. For whatever the cave, whatever the reasons may be that they had this personal animosity towards each other, but it's being used as a tool, as another pawn, if you will, in their personal battle. Ad Kan, up until now, we've dealt with this one episode. Let's fast forward a number of years. We're going to stay on the Lower East Side, but we're going to fast forward a few years. And again, I can't give you an exact year because we're not exactly sure when this took place. That's this next episode, okay? Part two of this, we're not sure exactly when it took place. Later in the 19th century, perhaps even early in the 20th century. At this point, we're talking about the same congregation. There had been various splits in the congregation, and now it went by, or this particular split, became known as the Beth HaMedrash HaGadol. By the way, this congregation was in existence. It might still be in existence. The building, which we're going to refer to in a second, unfortunately burnt down a few years ago. It was in the news. You may have read about it. But this congregation, Beth HaMedrash HaGadol, finally purchased a permanent building on Norfolk Street. Again, still on the Lower East Side. But lo and behold, the building that they purchased on Norfolk Street also had once upon a time been a church. Now, the Beth HaMedrash HaGadol had become a stronghold of Lithuanian-bred leadership on the Lower East Side. Okay, so the rabbis, the congregation, for the most part, originated in Lithuania. And now we bring into the picture another colorful rabbinic character on the Lower East Side, Rav Yehoshua Sigal, or Siegel. Rav Sigal hailed also from Galicia, okay, so not from Lithuania, but from Galicia. And he wrote or published a collection of tshuvos titled Ozne Yehoshua from his time in New York. And in, if you peruse, if you look through the Ozne Yehoshua, you see that Rav Sigal had numerous critiques of the halachic scene in New York at the time of his arrival, at the time of his being here. So he has a tshuva on this very same question. Can a church be turned into a shul? Now, in the tshuva, like I said, I can't give you an exact date. I also can't give you an exact context as to which building Rav Sigal is referring to. There's no indication whether he was referring specifically to the Beth HaMedrash HaGadol, which had, again, on Norfolk Street, their permanent building, which had once been a church and now been turned into their permanent shul. But regardless, he takes a vociferously, very, very negative approach to the question at hand. And I will quote from you. He says as follows. He says, how does he approach this question? He says, this has already been made for them here in New York completely permissible to purchase houses of idolatry, their places of prayer from the Gentiles. And they make them into synagogues for prayer, synagogues for the public. And listen to what he says. And this is for them a simple matter of permissibility. And in addition, it is a mitzvah to turn the impure into pure. And this is like the way of all the ignorant who have their own unique Torah for themselves. And so it's clear, and he comes out, if you read through the entire tshuva, it clearly comes out on the Machmir side of this, right? Forbidding the usage of, for the most part, forbidding the usage of a church and turning it into a shul. And he has, as we just read in the introduction to this tshuva, he has very sharp words for the poskim that and the congregations that had allowed this and that were doing this. Why do I say that it's important that Beth HaMedrash HaGadol had become a stronghold of the Lithuanian leadership and the Lithuanian community on the Lower East Side, whereas Rav Sigal originated from Galicia? So we have other cases. We have other cases of Rav Sigal asserting his Galician, right, his Galician or halachic status against the Lithuanian stronghold on the Lower East Side. As one example, and this is somewhat related perhaps to the Beth HaMedrash HaGadol, but we won't go into all of that right now. When the famous episode of when the communities come together to elect a chief rabbi for New York, the first and only chief rabbi of New York, who do they elect? Rav Yaakov Yosef, right? Rav Jacob Joseph, who came from where? Lithuania. Rav Sigal was not happy with that, and he formed his own Bezdin, he formed his own rabbinic court, and he called himself also the chief rabbi. So he tends to, clearly something personal there also, in terms of he was an assertive personality, but aside from that, we find cases and instances where Rav Sigal was asserting his Galicianer's Galician halachic status against the Lithuanian hold on the Lower East Side, and this case may be another, right? This case of turning a church into a synagogue, which had was permitted, and was permitted for the Beth HaMedrash HaGadol, which was the Lithuanian stronghold. Perhaps I'm suggesting that Rav Sigal was also asserting his Galicianer status by prohibiting this. And we know that historically there was much infighting, unfortunately, on the Lower East Side between these sub-communities, right? So everyone, we can't group everyone together as, oh, Eastern European immigrants that lived on the Lower East Side. There were Lithuanians, there were Galicianers, there were Romanians, there were people from Poland, other parts of Eastern Europe, and there was often, not saying always, but often, quite a bit of animosity between these various groups for different reasons. And so to conclude, it is clear that the halachic issue of turning a church into a synagogue, into a shul, continuously served as ammunition in the wars between individuals as well as communities on the Lower East Side. Like we said, in its first manifestation, the controversy remained quite local. It served as a point of contention between two personalities, Rabbi Ash and Rabbi Middleman, and served as another episode in their continuing feud on within the community on the Lower East Side. Later, as we just presented with Rav Yehoshua Siegel and the Beth HaMedrash HaGadol, later it seems that the same halachic question became part of a broader conflict. Not just pitting rabbi against rabbi or individual against individual, but pitting perhaps community against community. In this case, Lithuanians against Galicianers on the Lower East Side. And so the issue at hand of turning a church into a shul shows us how personal and group allegiances express themselves in different ways, including, as we've shown, in the realm of halacha. The question of whether a church may be turned into a synagogue, therefore, was not purely a halachic one, and this is perhaps the main reason that we've dealt with it in today's shiur, but it was symbolic of the splintering between individuals and the splintering between subgroups and the maintenance of identities which were so central to the immigrant experience, to the Eastern European immigrant experience in New York.